Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm William Murphy and I represent the appellants in this matter, Nationwide Motor Sales, and its two principals, William and Brandon Schaefer. This is a case that involves the district court's failure to require the plaintiffs in this matter to honor an arbitration agreement, which they all executed. We asked the court to hold that the arbitration agreement is valid and that the employees at issue are required and need to arbitrate their claim. The arbitration agreement here is part of and included within an employee handbook, which is part of the appendix. It appears on the appendix page 136. It's a 5-paragraph agreement. It includes the first paragraph, which says, I expressly agree that except as otherwise provided, any claim that arises out of or relates to my employment or termination of my employment must be resolved through final and binding arbitration. It then goes on in the next several paragraphs to describe the arbitration process. And it says clearly that an aggrieved party, which could be either the employer or the employee, has to take certain steps to initiate the arbitration. And it defines how the arbitration is to be conducted in front of the AAA in Washington, D.C. The last paragraph says that by my signature on this acknowledgement receipt, which is also included within the handbook, I confirm that I've read and understood each of the four sections set forth above in this agreement.
Let's move to the issues in the case, and it seems like it starts out and begin. The question is whether this is a mutual bindness in terms of the arbitration on both of the parties, and it seemed to be some indication that perhaps one side is, but not the other. How do you address that?
Well, I think that this agreement is written very much in terms of mutual agreement. Both sides are covered by the agreement. And I would refer the court to the decision of this court in Hill versus PeopleSoft, where a very similar, actually a much simpler agreement. I'm sorry, not Hill. I'm referring to O'Neill versus Hilton Head. That was an agreement that was one paragraph that says, I understand that my employer makes available arbitration for resolution. And I understand and I agree to submit any of my complaints to a final decision of the arbitration panel. And in that case, Judge Wilkinson said that any doubts concerning the arbitrable issues should be resolved in favor of arbitration, whether the problem at hand is the construction of the language or the allegation of waiver or delay. He said that the employer had proffered the agreement, the employee had accepted the agreement, and therefore each of them was bound by the process. The court went on to say that, you know, the employer having created this agreement and asked the employee to agree to submit all claims to arbitration, the employer was not permitted to just walk away and say it only applies to the employee, it doesn't apply to me. In this case, our agreement, Nationwide's agreement, is much more mutual. I mean, it talks about aggrieved parties. It doesn't say just that the employee applies. Furthermore, Judge Gallagher decided this case really based on a clause that appears at the end of the manual and also at the end of the acknowledgement of where the employee signs and says that he's agreed to these things. Now that clause, it appears, it's the last page of the agreement of the handbook. And what it says is that, first of all, it points out that there are several agreements contained within this handbook. And I think that's very important because the effect of Judge Gallagher's opinion is to vitiate all four of the other agreements. There's an agreement with respect to the use of demonstrator vehicles, that an employee is not allowed to loan the vehicle to someone else, can't drive around with four or five.
Do you agree that the modification clause that you're talking about is illusory as applied to anything?
I think what the clause says and what it talks about is company benefits. There are a variety of benefits described in the handbook, and the employer
it comes at the end of the acknowledgement, correct?
It comes
it's on the acknowledgement form.
Yeah, but it's
does the acknowledgement form is the employee acknowledging the arbitration provision?
The employee in the beginning of the form there's a specific reference to that agreement, and there's several references to other agreements. And then the last paragraph talks about policies, procedures, and benefits, which the employer may change.
So is the employee, by signing that acknowledgement receipt, acknowledging to the arbitration provision?
This is evidence that he read it and understood the agreement. But it also
doesn't the arbitration provision itself refer to the acknowledgement receipt that the employee must sign in order to acknowledge the arbitration provision?
Well, it says, the last paragraph says, by my signature on the acknowledgement receipt, I confirm I've read and understood each of the four paragraphs set forth above in this agreement. But the disclaimer, if you will, does not say that the other agreements, this agreement and the other three agreements, are subject to change at the whim of the employer. It doesn't say that. It doesn't refer to agreements being subject to changes in the future. And in other decisions,
isn't the modification clause very similar to modification clauses that have been found illusory in other cases?
No, Your Honor. I think the difference is that this agreement stands on its own. The arbitration agreement does not make reference to the ability of the employer to change it.
When you say the arbitration agreement, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to that page in the handbook, which sets out the agreement.
Okay. We only look at that page. You're saying that page is the agreement. Both parties agree to that agreement?
Well, we know that the
employer... Do we have to look somewhere else?
We know that the employer agreed to it because the employer proffered it to the employee. He gave it to him and said, this is my policy. This is my offer. Do you accept
it? So the employer agreed to it. How do we know the employee agreed to it? What do we look at?
Because he signed the acknowledgement saying, I've read it, understand it, I'm agreeing to it.
And right above the employee's signature is the modification clause.
Understood. I understand that.
Okay. I think Judge Rushing actually had a question.
I did. I wanted to ask about, you keep mentioning the policies, procedures, and benefits, and that's what the modification clause says you can modify. But it didn't look to me like, and I wanted to get your thoughts about, in the handbook, most things are not called policies, procedures, or benefits. There's some things that are called agreements, as you point out, but most things don't have any one of those labels. So how do I know, according to your theory, what is covered and what isn't covered by the modification clause?
Well, a lot of the things are fairly, you know, standard kinds of, you know, dress codes and telephone courtesy and maternity leave, things like that. I think it's pretty clear from the phrase at the end of the acknowledgement clause that what it is talking about is benefits that are made available to the employee, which are subject to change.
Yeah. You know, it says policies, procedures, or benefits can be changed, abolished, modified.
Well, the full paragraph, I mean, the full sentence says, I further understand that the employer has the right from time to time to make and enforce new policies or procedures and to enforce, change, abolish, or modify existing policy, procedures, or benefits applicable to the employees as it may be necessary with or without notice. It never says agreements. And there are four very important agreements that are set.
But that's my question. That's my question is there are agreements in the handbook, but there are a lot of things that aren't called policies or procedures or benefits. And you want to hang a lot of importance on the title of agreement. But I'm trying to correlate that with what's in the handbook under your argument.
Well, my argument is that with respect to the agreements are not subject to unilateral change by the employer because it doesn't say that they are. And Your Honor, I would like to, you know, refer the court to a case that we didn't talk about in our briefs, but it came to my attention later. It's Ashford versus.
Okay, wait. Did you give this case you're about to talk about to opposing counsel?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Did you, but the court doesn't have it?
No, unfortunately, I did not pick it up until getting ready to argue the case just the other day. I sent Mr. Markovitz an email telling him that I would rely on this case. It's a case that Judge Rushing sat on the panel. It was decided.
Okay, well, go right ahead. But I would suggest that if you had time to send opposing counsel the case, which I commend you for, you would have had time to send it to the court as well.
I didn't think it was appropriate as a 28G letter, Your Honor, because it came down in 2020 before we had briefed this. So okay. I didn't think it was really appropriate in that sense. But the case was Ashford versus PricewaterhouseCoopers. And the very first sentence.
What's says, the site for it?
I'm sorry, 954F3rd 678. It's a 2020 decision written by Judge Quattlebaum, Judge Niemeyer, and Judge Rushing joined. The Federal Arbitration Act expresses a strong policy in favor of arbitration. Based on that, the Supreme Court and our court have consistently held the contractual provisions capable of being reasonably read to call for arbitration should be construed in favor of arbitration. And the court went on to say that we review de novo the enforceability of an arbitration provision and apply the strong federal policy in favor of enforcing those agreements. The FAA's policy of favoring arbitration agreements augments the ordinary rules of contract interpretation and requires all ambiguities to be resolved in favor of arbitration. I believe that Judge Gallagher's approach in this case did not comport with Ashford. That she essentially applied a summary judgment standard and said she was going to indulge all inferences in favor of the plaintiffs because we were in effect seeking summary judgment. That's not what a court should do under the Federal Arbitration Act. You should interpret the agreement consistent with the strong federal policy in favor of arbitration. And if there's any ambiguity at all, it should be construed in favor of arbitration. In this case, we have a reasonable interpretation of this agreement and the acknowledgement.
How does that square with the ambiguity goes against the drafter
that
of a document?
Right. That policy does not apply. That's what this court holds in effect in Ashford. That policy does not apply when you're construing an arbitration clause because of the Federal Arbitration Act and its strong policy.
Well, counsel, to give you the benefit of the presumption in favor of arbitrability, don't we have to first see that we have a valid contract, a valid agreement to arbitrate?
Yes. And you do. But the reason that this is a valid agreement to arbitrate is that it's not an illusory promise. We made a promise, our company made a promise that it would arbitrate. We had an affidavit from the general manager, Brandon Schaefer, who said it has always been our policy that we will arbitrate all employment disputes. This policy has been in effect since 2004. There has never been a court case where Nationwide took an employee to court. They have resolved each and every employment dispute through the informal mediation process, which has got the arbitration clause as part of that process if informal mediation fails. So this is a situation where this employer has always consistently applied the arbitration clause, has lived by it, has honored it, and these employees have refused to do so. Two of these employees.
So you made a statement in terms of the presumption in favor of arbitrability. That really goes more to the question of validity of the arbitration procedure, not to the scope of it. Isn't that correct?
I think that in Ashford, what the court said is that it goes towards the role of the court in interpreting what the contract means and whether the arbitration provision is valid as applied. In Ashford itself, it was a very unusual arbitration clause where PricewaterhouseCoopers.
So I want to make sure I said that right. The presumption applies to the scope of the agreement, not to the question of its validity.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what another passage from Ashford.
Well, check that out. Well, you're going to have a little time in rebuttal. I want you to check that out because that presumption is important. There is a differentiation in arbitration. And I think typically arbitration is properly applied when you're interpreting the scope of the arbitration. You get that presumption, but when you're dealing with the validity of it, that's a different question.
I think that the scope is,
in fact, I think you agreed when Judge Rushing raised that as well.
Well, I agree that there has to be a valid agreement to arbitrate. I agree that you just can't impose a, you know, willy-nilly upon an employee. But
well, we want to get this whole concept of what you mean by the presumption in favor of arbitration. That's the key point you're making there. And here you've got this acknowledgement statement that is a part, to some extent, of this agreement. And it even says it. I guess if you don't sign that acknowledgement agreement, you don't even have an agreement. Is that correct? If you don't sign the acknowledgement, do you have an agreement?
I would think if the employee didn't sign the acknowledgement, he wouldn't have gone to work for the employer.
But the question is, do you have an agreement?
That may follow, but the question goes to whether you're going to have an arbitration agreement if he does work there, if he doesn't sign it.
I think, Your Honor, to answer the question, I'll try to answer the question. In Hill versus PeopleSoft, we had a situation where there were two agreements. One was an arbitration agreement, and another was a policy or program that defined mediation, arbitration, and everything else.
Well, Hill had an arbitration agreement that literally was a separate document. I mean, it was a separate document. This arbitration, when you're dealing with arbitration not signed by anybody and expressly incorporating the acknowledgement, you got a different situation in Hill. Well, at least the trial judge felt so.
The trial judge felt so, but I don't think the trial judge's ruling is really consistent with Hill. Because in Hill, the IDS that PeopleSoft had included the arbitration as part of it and said that the IDS program, the employer reserved the right to change or modify without notice.
So, okay, what we're going to do at this point, I'm going to ask the judges, do you have any further questions at this point? Otherwise, we will let you come back as you've reserved time for rebuttal. Judges, anything further at this point?
No.
All right, we'll proceed on to hear from the appellee in this case.
Thank you, Judge Wayne. May it please the court, my name is Brian Markovitz, and we represent Mr. Cody and the other salesmen that worked at Nationwide Motor Sales Corporation at their Fort Park dealerships. Judge Gallagher got this correct. This matter falls clearly within Cheek versus United Healthcare, which has been good law by the Maryland Court of Appeals since 2003, and the subsequent cases relying upon Cheek. The district court did what it was supposed to do here. It decided whether a contract existed consistent with this court's Berkeley City School District decision, and the district court was correct.
Cheek was a federal district court case out of Maryland?
No, Your Honor. Cheek was from the Maryland Court of Appeals.
I have the other case. The Chertik case is what I'm looking at. Go ahead.
Chertik is the district court of Maryland. That is correct. And it's Judge Schwong. Your Honor, the district court was correct. You must have a contract before compelling arbitration. As Judge Rushing just had a discussion about Ashford. Ashford did not overturn the holding in Atkins versus Labor Ready, and I'll just quote that for the court. Even though arbitration has a favored place, there still must be an underlying agreement between the parties to arbitrate. Mr. Murphy is putting what the district court referred to as the cart before the horse. You have to have an agreement to arbitrate first. And I would also further note that when Mr. Murphy says that his client has never taken any steps to get out of arbitration, and that may be true, but Cheek also counsels that that doesn't matter. You look to what the agreement language says. And frankly, if you could focus on parties' actions as opposed to what the language in a contract says, I mean, contract law would be kind of a mess. So, we would assert that focus should be on the language here. And the district court correctly found that there was no contract at all. Appellants are here, and they did this in their pleadings, and we also assert below, they're coming up with after-the-fact rationalizations to support their positions and what we believe is the tortured interpretation of the language that's in this agreement, which is evident by the questions that the members of this panel are asked previously. And
well, on this whole business of whether you had a contract and the mutual consideration, this O'Neill case, pretty strong case, and it's binding precedent on us. And some of the points you made, O'Neill went directly to address those.
Your Honor, O'Neill is a pre-cheat case that apparently addressed South Carolina law, and it didn't deal with in that case, and I'll just quote the court, it found multiple references in the AMI employee handbook which indicated that there was an agreement to arbitrate. I would point the court to the joint appendix, which is at 136, where the agreement is here, and paragraph one of the arbitration provision. And appellants have conceded that that provision only covers employees' claims, only. That's conceded. And when you read this language here, it's I expressly agree, meaning the employee. It only covers employees' claims. And therefore, O'Neill is considerably different because there are multiple references in the employee handbook that indicated that the employer was in fact bound to the agreement. We have no such thing here. I would note that Mr. Murphy just stated earlier, he referred to the aggrieved party in paragraphs 2 through 4 of this so-called agreement. It does not say aggrieved parties. It says aggrieved party, singular. And that's because the only party that can be file a claim in arbitration as conceded is from paragraph 1. And therefore, that is just the employee. So O'Neill is a completely different type of case. Certainly, if this had bound and been mutual for both parties, we would have a different situation. We do not have that here. And that is not what this language says. I would also note that recognizing this problem, that appellants have gone and they're arguing a passive voice argument. And I'm not going to pretend to be a linguistics expert, but let's, giving them the benefit of the doubt, assume that there is some passive language in 2 through 4. It still doesn't change the fact that paragraph 1 has set the universe of claims that exist in this so-called agreement. And those are only the employee's claims that has been conceded by appellants. And there's no language in 2, 3, or 4 that expands the universe. Yes, Your Honor.
It sounds to me like you're arguing that unless the party's rights are the same, they're not both agreeing to be bound. Can't they both agree to be bound by the agreement, even if one party has to arbitrate claims, but the other, doesn't have to arbitrate those particular claims? I'm not saying that's what this contract says, but they don't have to have the same obligations. They both just have to be bound by the agreement.
Your Honor, that I would agree with you, and I would assert that this agreement, you don't have to have the exact same claims. I'm not asserting that. What I'm stating is that there are no claims whatsoever that have to be presented at all by the employer. And that they do not have to even go to arbitration. The aggrieved party, the process is laid out in paragraphs 2 through 4. The only obligation on behalf of appellant is stated in paragraph 2, and that's in the pre-arbitration efforts. And that paragraph states, this is a quote, this is at appendix 136, the parties will then make a good faith effort to resolve any dispute covered by this agreement on an informal basis, whatever that means. And I would point the court to a decision from Judge Blake, which is very persuasive to this situation, which is Reglani versus Ripken Professional Baseball. That's at 939 F sub 2D 523. And in that case, the agreement read very similar to what we have here. Judge Blake found that it was one-sided, onerous, and lacked consideration. And she noted that simply because the employer has a process for facilitating arbitration, that is not consideration. And so I would respectfully assert that there is no mutuality of consideration.
And I know we're asking you questions about this, so it's totally appropriate for you to be talking about it. But the district court didn't decide this question, correct?
I mean, she certainly focused more on mutuality, I mean, on the revocation clause. I do believe that she had some language in there about mutuality. I would not say that was the focus of her case, of her order, but she definitely focused much more on the revocation clause, and she certainly reserved on all the other issues. She didn't.
Well, if we rule in your favor that this is not a valid agreement because of the illusory language, do we need to reach the mutuality issue?
We do not. That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, if agreement's invalid for any reason, then I can't say. You'd have to get to some of the other issues. You'd have to have some sort of agreement, and maybe unconscionability. You'd have to reach another issue. But with respect to the illusory promise, you would not have mutuality of consideration with the revocation clause, and therefore you would not have to reach on mutuality. I mean, that would certainly not make it a valid agreement as under Cheek. So what I would say here is that, you know, concluding on this, just to sort of, I guess, put a bow on this, paragraphs 2 through 4 do not add any mutuality of consideration. Paragraph 1 is the universe of claims. The argument about passive voice does not change the fact that there's a grieved party. It's not parties. And therefore, there's no mutuality of consideration. I would assert that this case is very similar to the Newhey versus Toll Brothers case from this court, which is from 2013. In that case, there was only one party that was bound to the agreement. It was it dealt with buyers and sellers of mortgages. One party had to follow certain procedures to initiate the arbitration process, as here. Only one party could make claims covered by the arbitration, and the plain language only referenced claims by one party, the aggrieved party, which is, again, the employee. And there was no consideration found by this court. I would also note that I think Newhey's, in some ways, was, you know, even worse than our case that we have here, because Newhey at least stated that any and all disputes would go to arbitration, and this court still held that there was not a mutuality of consideration. As Judge Wynn noted, this case is not like Hill. Hill had a separate, let me touch on this for mutuality of consideration. In that case, on its face, it required both parties to arbitrate. And I'll touch on the revocation clause in a second here. Finally, Your Honor, as you mentioned, Chertak. I think Chertak, which is a district court case from Judge Schwong, is very important in that it's very persuasive, because there were actually two agreements in that case. There weren't one. Appellant keeps talking about one agreement, but there were actually two. And one of the agreements, there was one that applied to only the test takers of the ACT, and there was another one that was a general arbitration provision. And this case very much illustrates the way this goes with mutuality of consideration. The one that had only applied to the test takers, Judge Schwong found was invalid for want of consideration. There was not mutuality. However, the one that was a general provision that was applied to all the claims except save a few between the test takers and ACT, he found that one was
speak to the illusory issure that's before us here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And this language and reference in particular the arguments that your opposing counsel made.
Sure. So I think the important thing here to acknowledge, and Judge Wynn, you sort of hit the nail right on the head here, which is, I mean, you know, this is like the old Maine saying, you can't get there from here. The problem that appellants have is that they have to have this acknowledgement receipt in order to have some sort of agreement on paragraphs 1 through 4. And the acknowledgement receipt, Mr. Cody's, is at the appendix at 171. But the problem is that they have this reservation of rights clause that, you know, clearly applies to the 6 bullet points above. And so in order to get some sort of acknowledgement that the employees, in fact, got this agreement and read it and signed off on it, they have to refer to the acknowledgement receipt, and these two documents actually refer to each other. And again, that revocation clause is right below. The appellants are trying to make this distinction between an agreement and a policy, and I guess now at argument here, they're talking about benefits. But when you look at the language here, and as Judge Gallagher correctly found, there's nothing in the language here that indicates that agreements, these are four separate agreements. In fact, the handbook says it's intended as a reference source regarding these policies, procedures, and benefits. And let's be clear, I mean, no one on this Zoom call, for instance, would draft an agreement or the acknowledgement this way if agreements were supposed to be outside of the revocation clause. You would have at least some language in here that would state something to the effect of the four bullet points above that state as an agreement or not, the revocation clause does not apply to this section. You would either maybe have them in a separate heading or a separate section, and none of that is present here. The average reader looking at this, or just a legal reader as well, would never look at this and say, oh, four of these six bullet points are not included as being applied for the revocation clause. And the revocation clause reads almost exactly like Cheek. And so we would assert that this is an after-the-fact creation or rationalization to try to justify something else than what this agreement says, this acknowledgement, and that the court has to look at this in order to even get to arbitration. The court's indulgence, one second. With respect to Hill versus PeopleSoft, which appellant is citing, I think that case is almost in some ways the reverse of our situation. You had in Hill, you had this program, this IDS program, and Hill, this court noted at least twice in there that IDS program did not contain a signature, and so the fact that an offer letter referred to it being incorporated, it was separate and outside of the actual arbitration agreement. Here, in order to even get to the employee having knowledge, you have a signed document, which is the acknowledgement receipt. And then on top of it, it's in an employee manual that also says in conclusion and has this very similar revocation clause. So that case is essentially the opposite of what we have here. I would assert that this case is very much like two district court opinions, one by Judge Bennett and another by Judge Grimm, which I think it's very persuasive, should be very persuasive for the court. One is Kyaire versus Conifer Valued Based Care, LLC. That's at 982 F sub 2E 582. That is a District Court of Maryland case. And in that case, Mr. Kyaire received an employee handbook with a so-called arbitration clause. There was an acknowledgement receipt that contained a revocation of rights, and Judge Bennett held that it was illusory based upon that revocation of rights clause contained in the acknowledgement receipt. Similarly, Judge Grimm, in an unpublished decision, Brent versus Priority One Auto Group, which is at 2016, Lexus 193735, which is from Judge Grimm in 2016, similarly had a situation where there was an acknowledgement receipt. And it also contained a revocation of rights clause referencing back to the so-called arbitration. And at the end, in that employee manual, there was also a revocation clause that seems very square to our case as well. And he held that was also an illusory promise and therefore no consideration. I just would like to just very briefly conclude by saying that, you know, it's our belief there's no mutuality. And that there's a revocation clause makes this illusory, and therefore there is no agreement. The presumption of arbitrability does not apply unless you have an agreement, and that this court should affirm the district court's ruling. To the extent that this court does not believe that the district court should be affirmed, we believe that the relief that is being suggested by appellants was incorrect because, as noted earlier, there are certain issues that have not necessarily been addressed by the district court, such as statute of limitations, unconscionability, and possibility. And therefore, the proper remedy, should this court not agree with the district court, is to remand it with instructions to address those issues because they were never addressed by the district court and therefore not before this court. I will reserve on the rest of my time unless any of the panel has any other questions.
All right. Well, thank you. I don't know what you mean by reserve it, but that would be the end of your time for today.
I guess so.
Do you have any further questions, judges, before we proceed? Thank you, Mr. Marcus. Mr. Murphy, you have just a few minutes, if you will. You may proceed.
Let me talk about three things. One, on mutuality. Obviously, the judge did not rule on it, and rightly so. The first paragraph that Mr. Markowitz refers to says, I expressly agree that any claim that arises out of or relates to my employment or termination of my employment must be resolved through final and binding arbitration. That's the passive voice language that creates a mutual obligation. The employer has given the employee this document. The employee says, I agree, all claims arising out of my employment must be resolved through final and binding arbitration. That's mutual.
I sort of read that. I thought that might be one of the weaker points you'd make if you want to reference that paragraph. There are some others in there that seem to have, not be the first person pronoun, but that I in there, I thought that was, maybe I read it wrong, but I thought that was probably the weaker point. You wouldn't focus on that.
Well,
but I got your point. I think you're trying to broaden it out to say that it's in context of something else. Maybe that's
it's all mutual as reflected in the other paragraphs, Your Honor, because the other paragraphs do refer to an aggrieved party, whichever party that might be, and the parties in paragraph two. Now, with respect to the clause at the end of the acknowledgement, I think that what Judge Gallagher failed to recognize is that there are, as I've said, four agreements contained in this document. One of them is the agreement by the employee not to misuse a customer's credit information, because car salesmen get all sorts of credit information, banking information, all sorts of information about a customer's assets. This agreement says you will not misuse that. Now, that agreement is now being rendered illusory, according to Judge Gallagher, because of this clause at the end of the acknowledgement. There's another agreement about not violating the telemarketing policies, which are set by federal law. There's another agreement that says you should not misuse your demonstrator vehicle. You shouldn't use it to commit a crime. Now, these are all agreements that these employees have made, which are, according to Judge Gallagher's opinion, rendered illusory by this admittedly awkward phrase at the end of the acknowledgement. But an awkward phrase or a lack of clarity does not dictate that there is no agreement, because again, I go back to Ashford. And what Ashford said on that point is, while the language of the agreement at issue is admittedly not a model of clarity, we do not review it with a clean slate. The FAA and our precedent tipped the scales decidedly in favor of arbitration. Since the reading advanced by Price Waterhouse is a reasonable interpretation of the language agreed to by the parties, we must construe the agreement to permit the arbitration of Ashford's Title VII claims. In like fashion, the interpretation that we have that clause about changing policies does not apply to these agreements, which the employee has said, I agree to be bound by this. I'm not going to misuse the telemarketing. I'm not going to misuse the customer's confidential information. I'm not going to misuse your demonstrator. All of those agreements, I think Ashford really resolves this issue about reasonable interpretations. If there is a reasonable interpretation that makes the arbitration agreement valid and binding, that's the interpretation that this court should reach. I think that's what Ashford said. And I think that is what we are saying, that there is a reasonable interpretation. It might not be a model of clarity, because these things are done by employers, and this one was done 16 years ago. But it's been followed, it's been adhered to, and there is a reasonable interpretation that makes this arbitration clause binding. And with that, I thank the court. Look forward to the day when we can all shake hands at the end of the argument.
As do we. That is something normally we would do, and hopefully post-COVID, once we are clear, we can resume that tradition that's, I believe, is unique to our court in so many ways, and something we relish is the opportunity to be with you. So thank both of you. Thank you, Mr. Murphy, Mr. Markovich, for being with us today, and we will take your case and environment on advisement in light of your great arguments.